This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sharon Brody, in for Meghna Chakrabarty. It's been more than a month since two bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Three people were killed. More than 260 people were injured in the blasts. And now the city has begun to heal. But some are asking, how should Boston remember or memorialize the events of April 15th?
A reminder of what happened is still very visible here in Copley Square. It's a spontaneous public memorial that continues to grow. People have left running shoes, lots of running shoes. They've left American flags, Irish flags, ribbons, hats and shirts, stuffed animals, and banners that read Boston Strong. But the day will come when all this will be taken away. So the big question is, what should take its place?
I definitely think we should have a permanent memorial.
This is Marisa O'Dwyer from Braintree, who stopped by the makeshift memorial.
The people of Boston, family, friends, and even strangers need a place to be able to come and spend time here and reflect on what happened and the people that lost their lives here.
I think it might be a good idea to have somewhere where people could come and just say, well done.
This is Jerry Mayer, and if it's not clear from his lovely accent, he's from Dublin, Ireland, here to visit his son. And he says he's a former marathon runner himself.
Well done to keep going. People came back and finished the marathon, and that sort is the spirit you want. You know, just keep going.
Another question has to do with this spontaneous memorial, which people continue to add objects to, but it won't be here forever. So what should be preserved, and how should it be preserved? Claire Shaboub of Jamaica Plain has some ideas about that.
I think we should keep all these stuffed animals and the shirts and all the hats that people left out. I think that should all be part of a memorial in some way, because you can really feel the love.
Absolutely. I think there should be a memorial. Yeah, it should be sooner than later.
This is Jude Okauchi, who's visiting Boston from Nigeria. He brings up another big question about this subject. If Boston is going to build a memorial, when should that happen? Some say it's better to wait, let the city heal, allow citizens to gain perspective on the tragedy. But others, like Jude Okauchi, say, don't wait.
If it takes so long, people might forget, you know, what actually happened. So I think it should happen very soon.
What happened in Boston was devastating to our city, and I think everyone needs to remember what happened here.
And Dorothy Morales Zulo of West Newton raises another question. What's the purpose of a memorial? To remember and honor the dead, the injured, to celebrate the city's resilience? Maybe both, or maybe something nobody has thought of yet.
But at the same time, they need to realize what strength our people showed toward the victims, and that we're going to be okay. We've all banded together, and we'll be okay.
Some voices there from Copley Square, gathered by producer Rachel Gottbaum. And from those voices, some questions and ideas that we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about now. Listeners, what's your view on a memorial to the events of April 15th? What should it look like? Where should it be? Is it better to start thinking about it now, or is it too soon? And what about that spontaneous memorial in Copley Square? What part of that should be preserved? Where should it be preserved and how? You can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. And joining us now is Rainey Tisdale. She's an independent curator based in Boston who specializes in urban history. She's working now with the New England Museum Association to create an exhibition for the one-year anniversary of the marathon bombing by collecting artifacts from the event. And Rainey joins us today from Washington, D.C., NPR Studios in Washington. Rainey, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there. Also with us is Ken Foote. He's a professor of geography at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's also author of the book Shadowed Ground, America's Landscapes of Violence and Tragedy, which looks at how violent and tragic events are remembered and memorialized across the country. And Ken Foote, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you.
Happy to be here.
Let me start with both of you. I'll start with Rainey first. Let's start with that spontaneous memorial that we just heard about in Copley Square. As we know, Mayor Tom Menino charged the city archives with a job of preserving and archiving the memorial materials, a process that I gather has already begun. But Rainey, does that mean that eventually everything will be collected and kept? The shoes, the teddy bears, the T-shirts, all of it?
At this point, yes, all of it. I think that there is a sense that right now, while it's still fresh and raw, it's hard to tell which of those pieces have the most meaning. And so if it's all saved for now, then there's time to sort of understand and process what it does mean. Now, probably that doesn't mean the flowers that will, sort of decompose, but most everything. And I should say that a lot of the paper materials have already been collected by the Boston City Archives. They are, more susceptible to the elements and to the rain we've been having. So much of that material has already gone to the archives in West Roxbury. And what's really still out there is mainly three-dimensional stuff, the T-shirts, the shoes, etc.
And Rainey, as a curator, I'm just curious. Why is it important to keep it all or as much as possible?
Sure. I don't know personally, and this is my personal opinion, that we will want to keep it all forever. But it's very clear right now that these objects have a lot of power for the city and even outside of Boston as well. And so I think there's a real need for time to understand what those objects mean and to have some time to sit with them. We know from past tragedies and other places that those objects can be such powerful symbols of the story. And so for right now, they really are these touchstones for Bostonians, for the running community, for anybody who cares about this event. And so right now, I think they have so much meaning that we should err on the side of caution until there's more time to sit with these things and understand them.
Mm. Ken Foote, I want to pick up with you on that point that Rainey made, the power of these objects. You were involved in thinking about what to do after the Oklahoma City bombing memorial. You've written about the Columbine shootings. In the wake of those cases, were there the kind of spontaneous memorials that we're seeing in Copley Square now? And if so, what became of those artifacts? And talk about just pick up on that theme that Rainey was talking about, the power of these objects.
I think these temporary memorials are absolutely essential to what happens later. I don't think they should be seen necessarily as just spontaneous or temporary. I think they're, in many cases, just as important as any kind of permanent or living memorial that comes later. They've not always been saved. I think that in some cases, like Oklahoma City or the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, there's been really an effort to preserve as many of them as possible. In New York City, they actually did dry the flowers that were found on city property. But in other cases, people don't see them quite as so valuable in the long run, and they're lost. And that, I think, is a bit of a pity because they really are important, particularly in that stage when people are trying to decide what to do at the site.
Mm. And say more about that. Important because it helps people sort of process what happened or because these objects as individual things actually have sort of power in and of themselves?
Well, I think in the early stages of these commemorations, there's a lot of debate about what to make of the tragedy. Was this just a lone act of terrorists, killers, and whatnot? Does it represent something more to the community, this sense of loss for the runners, of the loss to the community of Boston? And I think in that early period when these vernacular memorials go up, people are debating those ideas. And oftentimes the meaning is debated by the placement of items at the site and the meanings that people talk about and the way that they come up in the news and so on. So I think this is a very fluid time when a lot of the decisions about the kind of ultimate meaning of the event surface.
Mm. Listeners, we're talking about the memorial, really, a memorial, that spontaneous memorial that has taken shape in Copley Square after the events of April 15th. What do you make of that? What should happen to those objects? And looking forward, we're also going to talk about what a permanent memorial might look like. What are your views on that? We've got two great guests with great background on these subjects. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. Rainey, as we mentioned, you're working with the New England Museum Association to create an exhibition on the one-year anniversary of the bombings. What kind of artifacts are you collecting or looking for this exhibit?
Sure. So, of course, there are all the artifacts that are at that makeshift memorial at Copley, and they're a very important part of the story. But there are also these powerful objects, singular objects, that have become symbols of the event for all of us who watched it over and over again on video and in photographs. So for that, I'm thinking about things like Bill Ifrig's orange singlet. He was the runner, who older runner, who fell at the site of the first blast and then got up and finished the race. And he had that bright orange jersey on that we all saw on the TV that day. I'm thinking about those international flags that were flying in the impact of the bomb blast, and thinking about Mayor Menino's hospital bracelet. We all know, all of us Bostonians, how much this event has changed the narrative of his time in office. So objects like that that really symbolize this story that we all collectively experienced and are grieving for. So I think that if at the one-year anniversary there's a public exhibition, a public way for the city to come and see those objects, understand them as a way of accessing their feelings and their memories from the event. But then to go past that, which is something we really like museum exhibitions to do, and start a public dialogue in the city about what do we want our city to be like after this event, and how do we want to make Boston not just strong, but Boston better? And how do we transform those feelings of this awful tragedy into something positive and powerful and collective for our city?
Mm. And are you also referring to something permanent eventually? I mean, some kind of permanent memorial to these events?
Well, I think there's certainly lots of discussions going on in the city about permanent memorial. And, you know, that would be separate from this kind of exhibition of the objects.
Sure.
In my mind. But yes, you know, often in these after these events, a permanent memorial is on everyone's mind. And I think here in Boston, it's pretty clear that'll be the mayor's decision. He'll probably consult, folks whose opinion he trusts, and also consult the families of the victims themselves, to try to figure out what that means for the city. And, you know, I think there are a lot of considerations that come into play in terms of scale and, you know, the site. It's right there at the heart of Boston, those busy streets downtown at Copley. What's right for Boston, you know, Boston's identity and Boston's sense of self. And, you know, what kind of memorial is it? Is it a building? Is it a sculpture? Is it a plaque? Is it something else entirely that we haven't even, come up with yet? So all of that needs to be considered. And, you know, I think that's an ongoing issue right now.
And Ken Foote, I mean, looking at the way other cities have dealt with these kind of events, you know, what about the timing of this? Because it seems like as a city begins a dialogue with, you know, how to build, where to build, what kind of thing to build to memorialize something like this, perceptions change over time, people heal, the event, looks different with the passage of time. How do we sort of weigh all of those considerations as we think about this?
Well, I think one of the things that certainly happened over the last decade or two is that the speed has increased, so that this debate about whether to create a permanent memorial or whatnot, it's moved forward much faster. It's not unusual for events like this tragedy to be commemorated years later, even a generation or more. But it seems as though these days there is much more of a push to make a decision early. In some ways, I think that's not always so good, because it doesn't give people a chance to really consider the meaning and how things are going to be viewed. I think, though, one of the things that certainly come through recently is the use more and more of living memorials. I mean, I think it's certainly likely that there'll be a permanent memorial of some sort there on site where people can go and visit and pay their respects. But these days, too, people think creatively about ways that they can keep the memory alive, but in a positive sense. For example, the kind of thing that would be scholarships or funding to help runners or to help international runners to come to the event. Those sorts of things have a payoff, because they help to propagate the memory of the event far into the future. And I wouldn't be surprised if some sort of a living memorial emerges from this tragedy along with something that might be a permanent memorial there on the site as well.
Mm. Is there a risk of deciding and sort of engaging in this conversation too soon? I mean, it's one of the risks is that this event is horrendous as it is for so many people today, with the passing of time, won't seem quite as catastrophic a decade down the road, or 2 decades down the road, or a half a century down the road. Is that one of the reasons why I think you expressed concern about sort of launching too quickly into this conversation about how to memorialize it permanently?
I think there is there is this sense. I mean, we don't typically commemorate individual homicides. We don't put markers everywhere. The decision to leap forward on this sometimes can leave just kind of disused and, I think, memorials by the side of the road or on the city street where people don't understand. There's no connection, and it's almost a pity because those sites become lost and forgotten, and it's almost disrespectful in some ways to have them still exist once their time has passed. And it would be a pity to see that happen. There has to be some way of trying to keep that memory alive to sort of make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. But finding the right way to do it, I think that's where the time really does make a difference. People find something suitable, something that's going to have that effect without leaping into it too soon.
Mm. And Rainey, I want to ask you the same question, just that sort of the concern around perhaps moving too quickly on a decision like this. What are the effects
Sure.
of that?
Sure, Anthony. You know, I'd put it this way. If you had asked Bostonians the week of the bombings what kind of memorial we wanted, I think it's very possible when we were there at the height of our grief, many of us would have said, bring us the biggest thing you've got. We want all the bells and whistles. We want something the size of the Vietnam Wall. You know, bring us something incredibly important and powerful. But you know, once we make a decision on this, it is permanent, it is forever. So, and right now, we don't know whether this event is in the story of Boston, a chapter, a paragraph, a footnote. And in fact, in the story of terrorism, we don't know if it's a chapter, a paragraph, or a footnote. And we need a little time to work that out for ourselves. And then I think Ken is really right that, you know, having some time to think not just what's the quickest or the safest or the standard thing to do in this situation, but what's the thing that's really right for Boston, and what is the thing that might be living or be a powerful statement. The whole world is rooting for us right now. How can we make them proud about the choices we make here?
Mm.
That's what I'd like to talk to my neighbors about.
Listeners, we're talking about that temporary memorial, that spontaneous memorial in Copley Square to the Boston Marathon bombing, and also about the possibility of what takes its place when it finally is gathered up and archived and put away. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Jill, who's calling from Bolton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jill, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was recently at the 9/11 Memorial in New York, and in the visitor center they had a rather large Perspex display cabinet, and in that there was a polystyrene kind of Statue of Liberty that had been placed outside one of the fire stations, and they're not quite sure who placed it there, but a lot of the memorabilia and things that people left was attached to that statue, along with everything else that was left, and it's now being preserved in this large Perspex display cabinet. And it's quite large, and there was a lot of things in it.
Mm. So, Jill,
I thought it was a wonderful idea.
Well, Kenfoot, let me ask you about that, because one of the things I wanted to ask you was, I understand that in Oklahoma City, objects from that vast memory fence that encircled the 1995 bombing site were actually collected and eventually incorporated into the permanent memorial. So,
yes.
And that makes me think about what we're seeing in Copley Square and how they might one day be incorporated into a permanent memorial as well.
Yes, I think it goes back to the point that Rainey was making. These are such powerful objects, and to think that we would just dispose of them without thinking about that, because later they can be incorporated into the design, they can be incorporated into a museum, they can be held, they can be displayed in ways that I think are just as powerful as anything that we might build on site.
Hmm. I want to ask you, too, and sort of tap your knowledge as a historian here. I mean, I think you made the point that we're much more likely to create memorials around sort of singularly terrible events. But that wasn't always the case. I mean, for example, here in Boston, the Coconut Grove fire not that long ago, 490 people died. It's now a parking lot. I mean, What's changed since those days?
I think there has been, for a long time, hesitancy to mark sites that are associated with mass murder, terror, gangland killings, and so on. The shame of the event oftentimes stigmatizes the site. People are hesitant to bring those events forward because even honoring the victims also draws attention to the killers, the people who caused all of this tragedy. And so as a consequence, those sites tended not to be commemorated until quite recently. I think over the last generation, people have become much more attuned to commemorating the site of death, no matter how horrible, that something needs to be done for the victim. So the Coconut Grove example is a very good example from a generation or two ago, a horrible tragedy there not far from the Boston Common, a tremendous loss of life, and there was an effort really to, after the event, to scour the site of all evidence of the disaster. And I think the small plaque that is on the just by the parking lot now was put up 10 or 15 years ago. And it is touching in its own right because it's there. But clearly, people didn't want to be reminded of some of these horrible events. Mm. And so here we have another case. And it's, you know, in the long run, whether we want to draw attention to these kinds of killers, it's a tough question for most people.
Really interesting question. And really, really, really. Yeah, Rainey, you wanted to chime
Anthony,
in there.
Anthony, I would add on that, too, that with Coconut Grove, the artifacts, the objects from that story were not really collected by Boston's institutions. Private individuals did collect them, but it would be hard to have an object-rich exhibition about the story of the Coconut Grove without doing a bunch of loans from private collections. Mm-hmm. And there are other events from the 20th century where Boston didn't do a great job of collecting the busing era, Sacco and Vanzetti, the molasses flood. And so, you know, I think I would like to see us do a better job this time around.
Mm. Ken, let me come back to you. I'm just so interested in, and I have to confess, I didn't get a chance to read your book, Shadowed Ground, but I want to ask you about it. I mean, what drew you to this idea for a book, a chronicle of memorials of sites like these? I mean, what is the power in these memorials across the country that excited your imagination?
Well, in some ways, that book started just up the road in Salem because I remember visiting. I used to visit Boston quite often, but going up to Salem one day and asking about sites from the witchcraft executions. Hmm. And in those days, in my field, I was very interested in what people call the sense of place, the way people develop very strong attachments, very often positive attachments to place. And in Salem, I found people were very, very hesitant to talk about that episode. Certainly, there's the museum there. But this sense that all of the evidence from that witchcraft scare has largely been lost. People were so ashamed by it that the evidence was just kind of taken away or gradually lost through the years. And it was that sense of how these tragedies affect people's attachment to place, the way they affect the community as a whole. And from there, I began to just expand the investigation because I realized that one case wasn't enough. And I went on to consider many more cases around the country.
Mm. Well, here we are considering the newest and latest case. Ken Foote, professor of geography at the University of Colorado in Boulder and author of the book Shadowed Ground, America's Landscapes of Violence and Tragedy. Thank you so much for talking to us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Rainey Tisdale, thanks to you. She's an independent curator based in Boston who specializes in urban history. Rainey, it was great having you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony. And what a honor to follow Richard Blanco.
Well, the honor is ours. We're honored to have you as well, Rainey. Stay with us, listeners. The conversation continues at RadioBoston.org. And coming up, the history and beauty of the Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sharon Brody. This is Radio Boston.